The Americans have invaded the strategic island of Okinawa in the Ryukyus, 330 miles from the Japanese homeland. For direct word of this newest amphibious operation, the largest to date in the Pacific, we call in NBC war correspondent Robert McCormick at Guam.
This is Robert McCormick at Advanced Fleet Headquarters on Guam. You heard just a while ago Admiral Nimitz read his own communique, communique number 317, announcing the biggest, most critical amphibious invasion ever attempted in the Pacific, and one of the biggest of the entire war. We have invaded Okinawa Island in the Ryukyus, some 400 miles south of the main Jap Islands. It is home Japanese territory. The natives are Japanese. They've been under Japanese rule since late in the 19th century. The communique included one of the most gratifying sentences I've seen in an official announcement since the start of the Pacific War. It says our troops went ashore at 8:30 this morning, Tokyo time, and that they went ahead rapidly once they were on the beach. 2 hours and a half after they landed, they'd captured two of the airports on the island, the Yontan and the Kadena airports, and their losses were officially described in the communique as light. This surprised some of us, since we had thought that while the island itself might not be too terribly difficult to get under control, our losses on the beaches would be quite heavy. According to maps, the beaches have high ground around them, and the Japs should, according to all the rules, have put guns in these high places, guns which could fire directly down on the beaches. So some of us believed the landings would be bloody, although the rest of the island might be taken with comparatively light loss of life. Now we found the beaches were easy, and some of us suspect we may run into trouble later. Perhaps the Japs didn't expect us to make our landings on the west side of the island where we did come in. Perhaps they thought we'd come in on the east side, where the Japs have their best anchorage and where the beaches apparently are suitable for landing craft. At any rate, we have advanced at least 2 miles inland. We have taken a tremendous bite right out of the middle of the island. And there's another interesting paragraph in the communique, a flashback to the Battle of Iwo. It seems to be a continuation of the apologies for the heavy casualties on Iwo. The paragraph explains itself. It says, the capture of Iwo Island gave us an air base only 660 miles from Tokyo and greatly intensified our air attack on Japan. The capture of Okinawa will give us bases only 325 miles from Japan, which will greatly intensify the attacks of our fleet and air forces against Japanese communications and against Japan itself. As our sea and air blockade cuts the enemy off from the world, and as our bombing increases in strength and proficiency, our final decisive victory is assured. Admiral Nimitz also announced in communique number 317 the formation of a new army, the 10th Army, to prosecute the war against the Japs. The army is under the command of Lieutenant General Simon Bolivar Buckner, former head of the Alaska Defense Command. More than 1,400 ships have been brought together for this enormous operation. More than twice this number were used in the invasion of Sicily. Some 2,500 of our Navy ships were used in the Normandy invasion. But in the Pacific, the largest number of ships previously used appeared when we went into Lingayen Gulf, the first landing on Luzon in the Philippines, when we used 1,033 ships. And the next biggest was a fleet of more than 800 ships assembled for the invasion of Iwo. Now, getting back to Okinawa, before we went into the main island, troops of the 77th Army Division captured islands in the Kerama Group, just west of the southern tip of Okinawa. We began taking over these islands. We don't know just how many we landed on, but we began taking over these islands just 6 days ago.
This broadcast by NBC's Robert McCormick came to you from Guam by way of the NBC newsroom in San Francisco. Keep tuned to your NBC station for the later news.
Good morning from the NBC newsroom in New York. This Easter morning is the Normandy of Japan. The Pacific War's greatest invasion armada has put American Army troops and Marines ashore on Okinawa Island, 325 miles southwest of the Japanese homeland. And the Japs, glancing at history already made halfway around the globe, must see that invasion of Okinawa means to Japan what D-Day in France last June meant to Nazi Germany. We've landed possibly 100,000 men on Okinawa to deal with 60 to 80,000 Japs who have been battered for 10 days by the mightiest warship and carrier force ever assembled. This landing strikes on the western shore of Okinawa, a naval base little more than 300 miles from the Jap home island of Kyushu. It's a landing the Japs have screamed for a week was coming. They've talked all week about American invaders already ashore on two minor islands of the Kurama group off the southern tip of Okinawa. And now, directly from Admiral Nimitz himself, broadcasting from Guam this morning, the confirmation. Those Kurama Islands were seized, and we set up heavy artillery that supported the invasion of Okinawa this morning. It is the first time a major amphibious stroke in the Pacific by American troops ever enjoyed the protection of land artillery. Admiral Nimitz says in his first announcement that the Okinawa invasion has started off in high gear from a 7.5-mile beachhead, the Yanks driving 2 miles inland with casualties light and grabbing quick control of two airfields. A new American army is in this invasion, the new American 10th Army. Its commander is the veteran of Alaska, Lieutenant General Simon Bolivar Buckner, Jr. Members of the Marines' veteran 3rd Amphibious Corps also are struck for Okinawa beachheads, commanded by the airmen of Guadalcanal, Major General Roy S. Geiger. In the invasion fleet are more than 1,400 ships, American and British warships whose guns are blasting at Jap defenses and carrier planes, many of them British, which are giving support, a sea full of invasion craft that are feeding men and supplies to the beachheads. We've put 1,500 Navy aircraft in the sky over Okinawa and southern Japan during the 10-day softening up. And the stunned Japs, who, according to Nimitz, either were caught off guard or overwhelmed today, have lost almost 1,000 planes during these attacks. Admiral Nimitz declares that we've clamped a strangling sea and air blockade around the Nipponese homeland now. Victory more than ever assured because of the certainty that there'll be smashing warfare against those home islands on an ever-increasing scale. Okinawa stands between Japan and the island of Formosa, and Formosa is caught in an aerial crusher already under daily attack from the Philippines. And now, 6 weeks after the invasion of Iwo Jima, a still greater blow has been struck, hundreds of miles closer to Tokyo. From admirals and generals down through the ranks, the Okinawa invaders are battle-tested veterans. Overall command of the landing is under Admiral Richmond Kelly Turner, and Admiral Raymond Spruance is the Navy's task force chief. Top commander of the 24th Army Corps in the invasion is the hero of Bougainville, Major General John R. Hodge. Now from Tokyo, reaction is a typical stream of exaggerated claims about damage to the invasion force, and stories of resistance on Okinawa that Admiral Nimitz's first communique doesn't mention. It doesn't sound at the outset like another Iwo Jima. Tokyo propagandists try the same line taken in all previous setbacks, that this invasion gives them a golden chance to destroy the Allies in the Pacific and win the war. On the other hand, newspapers in Stockholm are running stories today about the gloomy talk of the Japanese who are living in Stockholm, saying that they've lost all hope. Okinawa landings, too, underlined the home front report that came yesterday from war mobilizer James Burns. He said victory in Europe can mean a little more of normal living back in the United States, but still a war with Japan that will hold all the top priorities. Over in Europe, it looks like General Eisenhower's decree to the German army yesterday sets the final pattern. No deals with the Nazis. Instead, the collapse of Hitlerism through unconditional surrender in whole or piecemeal of its armed forces. Now to the Western Front. Hitler's arrogant religion of conquest has led Germany to an ordeal of destruction this Easter. But it looks today like one more hopeless, uncompromising stand may be shaping up. Our Third Army spearheads, after the race deep into central Germany, appear to be running into a desperate enemy defense line along the Fulda River. It runs from the railroad center of Kassel down to Eisenach, 40 miles to the southeast. That's 160 airline miles from Berlin. And along that line, Patton's 4th and 6th Armored Divisions have run into some bitter fighting, the first real organized resistance since they crossed the Rhine. Latest report from Supreme Headquarters back in Paris adds that some more stiff opposition now confronts American 1st Army spearheads. Like nearly all of our most advanced forces, The front-running elements of the 1st are half-submerged in secrecy, but they're thought to be on the outskirts of Paderborn. That's at the eastern limit of the Ruhr. And German tanks, out of gas, have been buried and turned into pillboxes. In the meantime, a late report from Field Marshal Montgomery's armies tells how retribution has come crashing down today on thousands of Nazis streaming out of Holland. The tactical Air Force planes have caught up with the long lines of German vehicles, tanks, and trucks running for home. The bombers and fighters have turned this retreat into a nightmare for the enemy. They've snarled the roads with traffic jams, and they claim to have knocked out more than 680 of the tanks and trucks within a few hours. Frontline reporters say Montgomery isn't sure whether a full-scale German withdrawal from Holland is underway. England would like to hear that it is a full retreat from Holland, because Holland now is the V-bomb coast. Allied Supreme Headquarters says Montgomery's armies are at least 65 miles east of the Rhine, and that's probably the incomplete story. According to one report of the Luxembourg radio, Patton's American 3rd Army tanks have touched ground within 115 miles of Berlin. And somewhere in the drive through Germany now is the new American 15th Army. The French 1st is over the Rhine, and the American 7th has made a new crossing south of Mannheim. Other 7th Army columns far out in front are near Würzburg, and that puts them 105 miles from the old Czech border, 127 miles from Munich, and less than 200 miles from Berchtesgaden itself. The 3rd Army has led the miles-per-hour race in the latest reports, shooting ahead 50 miles in 36 hours to the vicinity of Kassel, and the huge roundup of beaten Nazis left behind continues. The prisoner count for Friday alone was almost 20,000. On the other hand, some unofficial estimates say we now have 1.5 million men, American, British, Canadian, and French, across the Rhine. That's Easter Sunday in Germany, and good weather means bombing, not a fashion parade. Montgomery's smash across the Lower Rhine a week ago yesterday was almost a repeat performance of the D-Day that came last June. It was blueprinted according to different specifications, though, a river, not a channel to be crossed. And the enemy knew fairly well where we meant to cross the Rhine, better than he knew where we'd strike against the Atlantic Wall. But all the forces of land and air, even the Navy, teamed up for the job on the Rhine. And today, the Allied Air Forces tells how that now famous unknown battle in the sky, which preceded the Normandy landings, was fought all over again to clear a way across the river. Montgomery's armies are rolling now through northern Germany because the enemy was knocked senseless and couldn't counterattack Montgomery's Rhine bridgeheads within 48 hours after the crossing. After 48 hours, it was too late. That's the airman's story. And they tell how 6 weeks of methodical softening up paved the way, another unknown battle. They began almost 2 months ago on the way-clearing phase, while the Navy, the land armies, and the sky troops still rehearsed for H-hour on D-Day. The armies wanted no interference from German planes, no immediate danger of counterattack, no major enemy line of defense left standing in the region where they meant to strike. They looked to the Allied Air Forces for assurance on these 3 points. Some 5 weeks of hard hammering by our bombers, striking at northwestern Germany, brought the target area to a narrowed circle in and north of the Ruhr by March 21st. And that day, Jimmy Doolittle's 8th Air Force sent out 1,400 of its biggest bombers to pulverize Luftwaffe airfields throughout the region. Then more of the same on March 22nd, the Luftwaffe brought to its knees and temporarily almost non-existent in the Ruhr. Finally, the night before the crossing, RAF heavies centered on the vital east bank town of Wesel, and attack planes of the 9th Air Force in the meantime directed more bullseye raids against airfields, communications, storage centers, even places thought to be German Army command centers. This concentrated fury left the enemy's defense machine a shambles for the cross-Rhine strike by air and assault boat of the morning of March the 24th. The airborne army landed within 3 hours. The Luftwaffe and the Wehrmacht never recovered. So Allied airmen take a bow for paving the way to another D-Day in the West. They helped American doughboys, British Tommies, Canada's fighting men, and the daredevil troopers of the sky to one of their great armored strikes of history. And it came at one of the smallest costs and casualties ever known, with so many thousands of men in action against a major enemy. Now to the Eastern Front. At least 60 miles of the eastern frontier of Austria is in Russian hands. Three Soviet armies advancing toward Vienna, and moving through more than 70 Austrian towns already captured. The famous capital on the Danube is just one of the three main Austrian cities directly ahead of the triumphant Russians. First of all may be Wiener Neustadt, an industrial town near Vienna that Allied bombers have been pounding for months. Part of Marshal Tolbukhin's 3rd Ukrainian Army is within 12 miles of Wiener Neustadt, and this army is little more than 30 miles from Vienna. It's closing now on the border town of Sopron. The other major Austrian city menaced by the Russians is Graz, a bottleneck in the railroad lines between Austria and northern Italy. In Czechoslovakia, Marshal Milanovsky and his 2nd Ukrainians are aiming another spearhead toward Vienna from a distance of 55 miles, and they're only 24 miles from one of the principal Czech cities, Bratislava. Russia's other army in this drive toward Hitler's southern stronghold is Marshal Konev's 1st Ukrainian. It mans a long stretch of the front in Germany, southeast of Berlin, and part of Konev's force is driving at Czechoslovakia from the northern side. It's within 17 miles of Moravska Ostrava. That's one of Czechoslovakia's industrial centers and the gateway of a northern route toward Prague and Vienna. Down there in the closest approach to Vienna, the 3rd Ukrainian Army has taken a fierce toll of enemy troops trying to make a stand. That army claims 8,000 prisoners and 4,000 enemy dead in its latest report and says the count is far from complete. And there are more heavy German casualties in that battle northward for the Moravian Gap. In the meantime, a savage preliminary to the next Russian surge toward Berlin has been fought near the Oder River fortress of Kustrin. Moscow says that more than 6,000 Nazis were wiped out when troops of the 1st White Russian Army struck down a pocket of resistance. Across the frontier areas of Hungary, Austria, and Yugoslavia, it's getting close to 100 miles, the distance separating the Russian armies from Italy. And in Switzerland, they hear that Nazi forces holding out in northern Italy are worried more about this new Russian offensive than any of Germany's present disasters, worried that they'll be trapped below the Brenner Pass. Whether it's Easter or pure chance, fighting on the Italian front is almost at a standstill. But airfields farther down the boot are humming. Planes of the Mediterranean Force have flown more than 2,200 trips to bomb places like Graz, Vienna, Prague, and Munich in direct support of the Russian armies. One urgent problem on the home front waits not even for Easter Sunday, a temporary agreement that'll keep bituminous coal mines running. For lack of a permanent contract to replace the one that expired last midnight, steps are underway to keep the old agreement in force during another month of negotiations. Everything involved in this plan for a truce is settled except one thing. John L. Lewis wants a written guarantee from the soft coal operators that whatever wage settlement finally is reached will be retroactive. They're busy in Washington today ironing out this demand. Chairman Van Horn of the Soft Coal Joint Wage Conference believes it will be ironed out by late this afternoon, and soft coal miners will be on the job tomorrow. Now here's a brief review of the top news of the moment. The biggest invasion of the Pacific War was launched this morning when the new American 10th Army invaded Okinawa Island on Japan's doorstep, just 300 miles from the Nipponese home islands. First reports on the fighting say the Americans are 2 miles inland, have captured 2 airfields, and that our casualties have been light. Now, over in Europe, the pattern continues the same, with Allied armies biting ever deeper into Germany. However, this morning, for the first time, some reports declare that the Germans are putting up organized resistance against the Anglo-American armies advancing from the west. And that's all the news for now. And this is Robert Denton, speaking from the NBC Newsroom in New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.